in which the theme of the broadcast is not everything is created equal, not Federal Reserve banks, not offshore wealth, not plans to overhaul the tax code. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, November the 6th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yeah, we are going to do some tax stuff today and a quick explainer on the key concept in the Paradise Papers that came out this weekend. We're going to begin, though, with a guy by the name of Bill Dudley, William Dudley, if you don't know him very well. Unless you follow banking regulation and monetary policy closely, there is no reason you should know him off the top of your head. But I mention him because he announced today he is going to retire next year as the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. That puts him in a very small circle of people who actually pull the levers that make this economy work. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more now on Dudley, the New York Regional Fed, and why it, above the others, matters.
There are 12 regional Federal Reserve banks. The New York Fed has the most responsibility, so does its president. First, he's the chief regulator for New York's huge banks.
The sort of cop on the street.
Anat Admati teaches finance and economics at Stanford.
Really implementing and enforcing whatever the regulations are.
Some of the New York Fed's regulators are actually stationed inside New York's big banks, as President William Dudley supervises them. He's also a permanent voting member and vice chair of the Federal Open Market Committee, which sets interest rates. As vice chair, Dudley tries to get everyone on the committee to follow the Fed chair's lead. It's a bit like herding cats.
Typically would have 19 people sitting around the table.
Andrew Levin is a former Fed economist now at Dartmouth College.
And they like to work by consensus, trying to get, you know, most people on board.
Once the Fed has decided what to do about interest rates, the New York Fed carries out the decision, buying or selling to get interest rates to the Fed's target. The New York Fed chair is in charge of that, too. Carl Tannenbaum is another former Fed economist, now at Northern Trust.
The responsibility for executing monetary policy is what led the framers of the Federal Reserve System to elevate the president of the New York Fed.
So he's the first among equals. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The global economy story of this Monday centers on the phrase tax havens, places for people at the tippy top of the economic pyramid, usually to put money they would just as soon nobody know about. You saw some of the usual suspects pop up in the Paradise Papers this weekend, the Cayman Islands, Barbados, the British Virgin Islands, to name just a couple. But Marketplace's Amy Scott explains being paradise is not a prerequisite for being a good place to stash your proceeds.
Think tax haven and you might imagine palm trees and ocean breezes. You probably don't picture
Delaware or Nevada or Montana or Wyoming.
But Cambridge University professor Jason Sharman says in those states, you can buy a shell company online, no questions asked, far more easily than in the Cayman Islands. Whether it's legal depends on what you do with the money. Clark Gascoigne is deputy director of the Financial Accountability and Corporate Transparency Coalition.
The lawyers will tell you that by definition, using the word avoidance after tax means it's legal, whereas using the word evasion means it's illegal.
So what's the difference? Gascoigne says shifting profits to a low or no tax country to avoid paying higher taxes at home is tax avoidance. Under U.S. law, as long as you keep the money offshore, that's fine.
Evasion would be if they were to, say, repatriate the money and pay it out to shareholders, but not actually pay the taxes on it.
George Turner is with the Tax Justice Network, a research and advocacy group focused on tax havens and offshore finance. He says sometimes the difference between avoidance and evasion is not so black and white.
You may be kind of obeying the very letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law.
And the revelations of the Paradise Papers may push officials to crack down on those gray areas. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
President Trump prides himself on being deal maker in chief, as we know, including, as we learned today, arms sales to foreign militaries. Today, on the Japan leg of his Asia trip, the president said the Japanese could shoot North Korean missiles out of the sky when they buy, quote, lots of additional military equipment from the United States. That would bring, the president said, and this is also a quote, a lot of jobs for us. Whether those jobs actually materialize following the sales is a whole other thing, though, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports from Washington.
There's nothing new about framing arms sales as job creation. It's one of many selling points, along with diplomacy and military coordination with allies. The thing is, sales do not always equal more American factory jobs. Sometimes it's like the iPhone, designed in America, assembled somewhere else. In today's case, by the Japanese, says Mark Kansian at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
They developed a Japanese version of the F-15 and then manufactured it domestically. The United States will provide engineering support, some components, but much of the manufacturing is done in Japan.
Still, this president actively cheers arms deals, to Japan in this case, and on a past trip to Saudi Arabia. And when this comes from the commander-in-chief, it can move the needle, says defense analyst Chris Higgins at Morningstar.
What you'll see is a lot more government support to make those deals happen. And that's important because it's a very regulated sector, and you really do need government-to-government contact sometimes to close these deals.
Many defense companies are optimistic under this White House, not just for sales to foreign militaries, but to ours, as in Pentagon spending. But weapon and defense systems are often made more by machines than people, says William Hartung at the Center for International Policy.
Pentagon spending creates fewer jobs than almost any other activity. And the reason is it's capital intensive. You know, for the people who have those jobs, it's very important. But in terms of employment stimulus, it's one of the least effective ways of going about it.
The U.S., by the way, is by far the world's leader in arms sales. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, traders keep on liking what they're seeing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you're a tax policy person, the House Committee on Ways and Means is the place to be this week. The panel is marking up, that is, formally considering amendments to the GOP bill that was made public last week. Along with that markup comes more public scrutiny of what's in and what's out of the proposal, as well as pressure from various sides of the debate. Neil Bradley is the senior vice president, also the chief policy officer at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Neil, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
I'm going to start with you the same way I started with Kevin Hassett, the head of the Council of Economic Advisors at the White House on Friday. Now that this bill has been out for a little bit and some of the knives are out, frankly, how are you feeling about it? What are you thinking?
I still feel very good. It's a pro-growth bill that's, if enacted, will be substantially better than our current tax code and would really boost the economy and, more importantly, middle-class wages.
There's a big if right there, if enacted. How are you feeling about that little bit right there?
Well, it's if right now, but we're looking forward to when it's enacted. I think they're going to get the job done. And they may not make the president's deadline of Christmas for enactment, but it won't be too long after.
We had you on the program back in August-ish, I think it was, talking about a note that the CEO of the Chamber, Tom Donahue, had sent out to members of Congress, which said, in essence, look, you got to hook us up with tax reform or we're going to campaign against you. I want to dive into that a little bit because there are some members of the Republican Party who have come out and said, you know what, I can't support this bill as it is right now. Where are you on the, you know what, you're with us or you're against us?
Well, we're open to changes being made to the bill, but the core structure has got to get enacted. If folks are going to stand in the way, then we are going to hold them accountable next November. And so we engage in a lot of politics. And one of the things we're going to look at when we evaluate candidates is, did you try to make the perfect the enemy of the good? And in doing so, try to block our first real chance at pro-growth tax reform in three decades.
Yeah, but you understand how that can be counterproductive, right? Let's look at Peter King, Republican from New York, which is a high-tax state. One of the things that Chairman Brady of the Ways and Means Committee has said is, listen, we're going to get rid of state and local deductions. And Peter King has said, no, I'm not doing that. You're going to campaign against Peter King, who's been a Republican stalwart for decades.
Well, again, I'm hopeful that we're going to get a product that Peter King and frankly, every other Republican and hopefully some Democrats actually vote for. If you can't find something that you don't like in the bill, you're not looking hard enough, which is why we encourage people to judge it on its totality. The bill in its totality is going to be good for Peter King's constituents in New York and, frankly, every other member of Congress's constituents across this country.
What are you looking for that you would accept changes-wise? Your note to folks the other day when this bill was introduced said you're looking for the exact right policy mix. What is that policy mix?
What's important is that the structural change of lowering overall rates, broadening the base, moving to a territorial system. Those are the kind of changes that are going to generate economic growth. Keeping that pro-growth core is what's essential.
Seems to me what you're saying is, listen, we've got to keep these corporate cuts. We can negotiate on everything else.
We have to keep the fundamental reforms. We have to move towards a system where we tax. We no longer are the outlier in the world who taxes businesses on their worldwide income. That we keep the lower rates for small businesses and big businesses. Those are key critical elements of this reform.
So that's a long way to say, yes, you're right. Corporate rates.
Well, it's corporate rates. It's the pass-through rates for individuals. And frankly, it's encouraging more investment. We want more people across this country, no matter what kind of business they're in, making those kind of investments that create new jobs, that raise wages.
New topic. How worried are you about the fact that a good chunk of this bill, $1.5 trillion worth, is not paid for, that it's going to boost the deficit by $1.5 trillion over 10 years?
I'm not, because that looks at it in the way that only Washington accounts for tax relief. If we grow the economy, which this bill will do, and we raise
we
wages.
Think, come on, which this bill will do, we think. Come on, I mean, you got a caveat.
Well,
right?
I'm sure folks will.
Okay.
But it's also true that, no, I don't think you'll find anyone who says this bill won't have an economic impact. We can argue over the degree of the economic impact. Okay. And the magnitude and the direction. There's no question you make this much changes to U.S. tax code, it's going to have an economic impact. We look at it and we say past history indicates it's going to have a positive economic impact that this bill can produce.
Except for the fact that tax cuts never really do pay for themselves, right?
Well, no one's saying that it's going to completely pay for itself. But there's no question that the best thing that you can do to begin addressing the federal debt and deficit is have an economy that grows at something bigger than, you know, mid 2% a year. You simply can't close the deficit and debt gap that we have with this little of economic growth. It's just impossible.
Neil Bradley. He's the Senior Vice President and Chief Policy Officer at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in Washington. Neil, thanks a bunch.
Thanks so much, Guy.
The GOP tax bill that Neil Bradley and I were just talking about is 429 pages long as currently written, subject to amendments, of course, during the markup this week. Among the proposals in the bill at the moment is one that changes the calculation for alimony. Specifically, alimony payments would no longer be deductible on the payer's tax return. That is, they would stay as taxable income. And on the flip side, those payments would no longer be taxable income for the ex getting the money. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains what that might mean in reality.
Not every divorce results in one ex-spouse paying the other alimony. And alimony's becoming less common, says Dana Britton at the Rutgers Center for Women and Work. Back in the 60s, about 25% of divorces included alimony.
Now about 10% do, because many, many more women are working for pay.
Currently, alimony's tax deductible, making it, if not painless, at least a little less painful, says John Slovacek at the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers.
So the high-income producer is able to pay a greater amount of alimony and take the deduction.
The GOP tax plan would take away that deduction, making alimony more expensive, which could make divorce settlements more difficult to achieve.
I think this will cause a lot more cases to go to court and go to trial.
Randy Kessler is a Georgia divorce lawyer and former chair of the American Bar Association's family law section.
I don't know many people that come into my office that say, well, I want a divorce and I want to pay a lot of alimony. We want to motivate that other side to voluntarily provide support.
Kessler predicts that ex-spouses with little or no income, and that's mostly women, will be left out in the cold. The recipient of alimony would no longer have to pay income tax on it under the GOP plan. But the financial disadvantages of divorce for women will remain, says Dana Britton.
Women's standard of living declines about 27% on average after divorce. Men's tends to increase about 10%.
And the net savings from these changes, according to the Republican tax plan, $8.3 billion over 10 years. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We'll be right back. Coming up.
Some people came up here with nothing but what they were wearing, so we're hearing need for winter clothes.
Where tens of thousands of Puerto Ricans are going. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 9 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 23,548. NASDAQ up 22 points, 0.3%, 6,786. The S&P 500 rose 3 points, about a 10%, 25.91 there. Chipmaker Broadcom clicked up 1.4% today. It made an unsolicited bid to buy rival Qualcomm for $103 billion American dollars. If the deal goes through, the biggest in tech history. Qualcomm up about 0.1% today. Phone stocks slammed down after Sprint and T-Mobile called off merger negotiations over the weekend. The firm said they couldn't reach a deal that would benefit customers and shareholders. Sprint slowed 11.5% today. T-Mobile USA down 5.7%. Verizon, in case you're curious, dropped 3.9%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today in correlation is not causation, this item. Crude oil topped $57 a barrel for the first time in more than 2 years today. All right, so maybe there is a little bit of causation, I guess, given the events in Saudi Arabia over the weekend. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman arrested more than 60 people, including 11 princes, in a corruption crackdown. We got Peter Waldman from Bloomberg on the phone to talk things over. We had him on last year after he spent a day or so with the Crown Prince in Saudi Arabia. Peter, it's good to talk to you again.
Hi, Kai.
This whole thing is being painted as an anti-corruption drive. You buying that?
Well, I think it's mixed. There's no question that they seem to have arrested a lot of people who have reputations in Saudi Arabia. This group, conveniently enough, included some outspoken people who've criticized the prince, Mohammed bin Salman, and as well as those who've laid fairly low. So I do think it's both. And I do think the prince has his eye on the younger population that is clearly unhappy with the way things are going in that country and would like to see a much more aggressive modernization push. And I think this is part of his appeal to them.
When we had you on a year and a half ago or so, you had just come back from a day-ish with Mohammed bin Salman. And we talked about some of the economic challenges, I guess, he faces. One of those is the younger population, as you just mentioned. The other one is, and bigger really, is diversifying the economy away from oil. Discuss that a little bit.
Well, as we discussed then and still now, they have this very ambitious plan to do a public offering of stock in Aramco, the national oil company, that could bring in, who knows, many hundreds of billions into the trillions of dollars that he wants to then recycle into non-oil investments so that eventually they'll have both external investments in companies all over the United States and Europe, but also so they'll invest in Saudi Arabia. Arabian companies and develop other natural resources besides fossil fuels, do other things to employ people there, which would be a huge boon if it ever worked.
One of the other things, though, that IPO, and if and when it happens, and I should point out here that the President Trump brought it up with the king when they spoke this weekend. One of the things that IPO will bring is transparency and sunlight into the internal workings of the Saudi royal family and its finances, which has to be on Mohammed bin Salman's mind.
Clearly, Saudi Aramco, the oil company, is a slush fund for the royal family. The thousands of princes depend on oil revenue directly for their lifestyles. This is something of a warning shot to them, I believe, this corruption roundup or anti-corruption roundup, saying to them, listen, your lifestyles are indeed threatened by what we're planning to do in this kingdom, and you better not complain too much about it. We're moving on. So I do absolutely think this is all connected.
One of the big names among the crowd that was arrested this past weekend is Al-Waleed bin Talal. He's a holder of, or has been a holder of, Citigroup stock and Ford and Hewlett-Packard and Twitter. He is somebody in the world of international investments.
He certainly is. I think Bloomberg ranks him as something like the 50th wealthiest person on the globe. We're certainly not aware of specific allegations against any of these people, but particularly against him. On the other hand, the public has wondered for years, both in Saudi Arabia and overseas, where did all that investment capital come from in the first place? So it could be an interesting file to open up.
What are you looking for next out of this thing?
I think we have to find out if this IPO is on track. That is the key question moving forward. Can he have that IPO and show the world that investors are confident in his management of Saudi Arabia. And I don't think that the instability this type of roundup presents will encourage a lot of these investors. I think there's clouds looming today that perhaps are thicker than a week or two ago.
Peter Waldman at Bloomberg Businessweek. Peter, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
The mayor of San Juan and the head of the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority are going to be on Capitol Hill tomorrow testifying about the still slow recovery from Hurricane Maria, which hit a bit more than a month and a half ago. As of today, only 42% of the island has electricity, and that enduring blackout is one reason that tens of thousands of people have decided the island isn't livable right now and thus have decided to leave. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson caught up with some of the new arrivals in New York City.
All right, thank you.
Jenny Nieves is in a borrowed winter coat, braving a crisp fall day to pick up her new benefits card.
For food stamps, Medicaid, some cash, too. I think it's twice a month.
She's been in New York about a week now. She taught second grade in Puerto Rico, but she's not licensed to teach here. She takes a spot in line and starts chatting with people around her.
Tú también, yo también, de Luquillo.
I'm already meeting people here that are from Puerto Rico, also like me.
Nieves and her 14-year-old son are staying with her niece in a one-bedroom apartment in the Bronx. She left her home in Luquillo, about 45 minutes from San Juan, because of the lack of power and water, the empty store shelves, and long lines for food. She also homeschools her son, so he couldn't do any of his online coursework without the internet. Her parents, in their 70s and diabetic, are still in Puerto Rico, which is really stressing her out. Her dad didn't want to leave their house.
I could be here another month. I could be here 3 months, 5 months. I'm just not sure yet. It's still too early for me to tell how long I'm going to be here.
She's also thinking about moving here for good. She says even before the storm, she considered leaving Puerto Rico because the economy there has been so bad for so long. This might push her to make the leap. The Center for Puerto Rican Studies at Hunter College estimates nearly 500,000 Puerto Ricans might leave the island in the 2 years after Maria. That's 14% of the population. Areas of the country that already have large Puerto Rican populations are preparing for a new wave of migrants. Florida's governor said his state already received more than 73,000 Puerto Ricans. New York has opened a hurricane service center in the Bronx to help evacuees tap into city and nonprofit services all in one place.
We're hearing mostly that people are looking for long-term employment. They want to make sure that their kids are enrolled in school.
Johanna Conroy is director of human services for New York City Emergency Management.
Some people came up here with nothing but what they were wearing, so we're hearing need for winter clothes.
Conroy says the center is operating near capacity and processed about 300 families in its first week. One thing New York isn't able to offer much of is affordable housing. Mayor Bill de Blasio said Puerto Ricans are welcome here, but he cautioned them against coming unless they have family or friends to stay with. Outside the center, Leslie Rodriguez loads her elderly parents into a car after spending a couple hours registering them for Medicaid and other services. Her dad was hospitalized with bronchitis just 2 days after arriving in New York.
What the doctor explained to me is that it wasn't a bacterial bronchitis. It was a bronchitis caused by the fumes of the generators.
She's lived in New York almost 20 years and said she's glad to be able to take her parents in, but it's been chaotic.
It's drastic because they need a lot of help right now. It's very overwhelmed because I want to be able to provide everything that they might need. They're having a lot of anxiety.
She'd like to reassure her parents they'll be back home for Christmas, but at this point, she's not really sure. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a quick bit of M&A news coming soon, perhaps to a movie theater near you. CNBC reported today that Disney has been in talks to buy most of 21st Century Fox, basically everything except news and sports. FX, the cable network, and 20th Century Fox movie studios among the key assets. Talks do seem to have broken down, but deals like this, as we've seen, have a way of coming back from the mostly dead. Okay, got to go. The Dow up 9 today, less than a tenth percent. NASDAQ gained 22, about 0.3%. S&P 500 up 3 points. We'll call that a tenth percent. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Haley Hirschman, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.